Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Let us get started. So just by a quick show of hands, who here is familiar with the story of Megillas Esther? Okay. So it's amazing that, you know, the story of Esther is the focal point of the entire holiday of Purim, and we read it twice, both in the morning and at night. Yet, you know, it's read quickly, and maybe you get to read it, and you don't get to read it, but to actually study the text of the Megillah, really, I've found, does not happen all that frequently. And it's a very, it's a tremendously exciting, it's a fun study, the study of the Megillah. There are tremendous lessons, obviously, to be learned as from the entire holiday. So we'll take this opportunity to actually learn through the text of the Megillah. Now, as I was preparing this, there were various different ways that I was trying to figure out how to go about doing this. So what I finally settled on is to take a chapter or two, I'll do the sixth and the seventh chapters, and read those inside. From there, because of the fact that I'm assuming that everybody here has a pretty solid grounding of the basic story, obviously, more or less, everyone's a little bit different, but the basic storyline is familiar to us. Through those chapters, we'll bounce around to various parts of the text. So even though we're starting in the middle, which you generally would not do, and we're going to bounce around, but because it's a general story that we're familiar with, I figure that'll be a little easier for us to follow, and we'll go through that, and we'll cover lots of other points through that that basic storyline. All right, so let's jump right in. Let us jump right in. So the sixth chapter, if you have an art scroll, chumash, make sure you pick one up. If you don't yet, it's on the sides. They're all available. The sixth chapter begins on page 1257, or you can find it in whatever text you may happen to have in front of you. Brief storyline where we're up to in the story, the beginning of the sixth chapter. This is where Esther has already approached the king. The letters have gone out. Haman plans on destroying the Jewish people. Esther has already approached the king and invited him to a feast, a little party that she is throwing for him and for Haman. They have both shown up to the first party, during which she, of course, invites them to a second party. Haman leaves the party feeling he's on top of the world. Everything is going really well. He's second in command of this large 127-province empire. Number two man, everything is going well until he sees his nemesis Mordechai, and then everything falls apart. At that point, and he goes home all distressed, and his wife comes up with a brilliant idea. Let us set up a gallows. We'll hang Mordechai on it on the next, whenever. He just doesn't give him the exact time. But she says, we'll hang Mordechai on it. You'll go tell the king about this tomorrow, and things will be well. And Haman thinks that's a great idea, and that's where we leave the story. That's where we pick up in the beginning here in chapter 6. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to read the first three verses. We'll read them together, read them in English. And I want you to look through them as if this is the first time you're hearing this story. Now with all the knowledge that you already have, all of the assumptions, a lot of times we read the story and we know the end already, so we forget to ask questions in the beginning because we know the end. We're going to read this question, we're going to read the first three verses, and we'll go through, there are a lot of questions we can ask, but there are three primary questions that need to be addressed in this first three verses of chapter 6. Let's read them together. That night, I'm going to read them in English just to keep things simple. That night, sleep eluded the king. So he ordered that the record book, the Chronicles, be brought and be read before the king. King can't sleep, so he orders the book of Chronicles be brought before him and be read before him. Verse 2, there it was found recorded that Mordechai had denounced Bigsana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains of the guardians of the threshold, who had plotted to lay hands on King Achashverosh. And what do they find as they're reading this book before the king on the night where he can't sleep? They find a story where Mordechai reported the actions of Bigson and Seresh, who had plotted to kill the king. Verse 3, what honor or dignity has been conferred on Mordechai for this, asked the king. Nothing has been done for him, replied the king's pages. Okay, those are the three verses we're all familiar. King can't sleep, he asks for the book of Chronicles to be brought before him. They read, they find a story about Mordechai. What honor have we bestowed upon him for this? What would the simple, basic storyline questions that we would have to read if we were reading the story for the first time?
Well, I was going to ask a different question.
Well, not ready for that yet. We'll put that up towards the end. Basic storyline questions.
If you were needing something to put you to sleep, would you be
Excellent. I don't know, is that the most normal thing to do on a night when you can't sleep? Having trouble sleeping, bring me my diary, the book of the Chronicles. Why did he ask for that book to be brought before him? That'd be something. Now, we're used to the story, so of course that's what they brought before him. That's an odd thing. Was that common, or is that the most normal response that he should have? He's tossing and turning in bed, and that's what he wants. Excellent. There's a question that needs to be asked before that.
Why couldn't he sleep?
Well, it's going to, all of a sudden, we're reading a lot about this in the sixth chapter. All of a sudden, on this particular night, the king can't sleep. Megillah is telling us something. We want to know, why can't the king sleep? Why can't he sleep? Why does he have this brought up before him? One more question. Okay, well, you're asking a question that's already... Okay, you're asking a question as to, on the response, as to why didn't they give him something before? Okay, so he was surprised, why didn't he know? There's a more basic question. Would your first response be, after hearing this story, hey, what did we do for him? I don't know if you would ask it as a question, but it's interesting. I guess we could put all these questions together as a conglomerate. Is it just me, or is it getting very warm in here? Maybe just because I'm the one who's speaking. Okay, getting comfortable, so you can leave it. Maybe just from my position up here. But, okay, so we have here... So, yeah.
My question was, did he know where to come from
Jews? Yes.
He did?
Yeah.
So that's why he didn't concern him.
Okay, possible. We don't have any evidence or reason to suspect that the king was an anti-Semite in any way. We don't have any reason to assume that he was opposed to the Jews. There's no evidence of that. So I don't know that would be a reason why he wouldn't have done that.
I think he was looking at whether the plots favored against him.
Okay, now we're getting into some stuff. So, meaning in terms of, why are you asking that?
Well, he couldn't sleep.
Okay.
So he got there, he laid down, he started thinking about the party and everything that happened. Was anybody else out there trying to kill him? Was he vulnerable?
Okay, getting to some of this.
That would tend to keep him awake, so now I want to know what...
Okay, hold on to that thought. We're going to have to develop that. Okay, so now there's also part of... So here we have this episode in which he can't sleep. We don't know why he's not sleeping yet. They bring this book before him. We don't know why he asked for the book to be brought. They find the story of Mordechai, and his first question is, what did we do for him? He doesn't ask anything, but it's a note that that's his question that he has upon hearing this is, what exactly did we do for Mordechai? One more thing? Are you answering the questions or asking? Which question? Okay, yeah, I'm not ready for answers yet. One of the storyline questions that we need to be asking reading the story. You're already giving answers, which we'll get to in a few minutes. So just as we read through these first three verses, we have the storyline of the king not being able to sleep. Why is he not able to sleep? Why is he bringing for this book particularly to be read? And his opening question as to what did we do for him? Let's start getting to some... Thank you very much.
Maybe he couldn't sleep.
I'm not ready for answers yet. I mean, we're going to start doing it now, but hang off on that thought. So what I want to share, the basic storyline that I want to develop through this chapter has been a combination of Rashi's commentary plus the commentary of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon is Rabbi Eliyahu, the son of Shlomo Zelman, who lived in the 1700s, one of the principal thinkers, Talmudists, that we had throughout the 17th century in Vilna. So he wrote a commentary on the Megillah. So there are two comments. And we'll throw in some ideas from Rabbi David Foreman, much more modern-day scholar, who I based a lot of the talks on from the Garden of Eden. So he has a lot to say on this story episode as well. But let's go through Rashi and the Vilna Gaon, who is referred to as the Gruh, an acronym for his name. Their approaches to these first three questions as we begin going through this text, reading through the story. So Rashi's first comment is a simple one, which is we're probably the most familiar with, that the reason why the king's sons couldn't sleep was simply a miraculous event. We have a Megillah story to go through. We have the Jewish people in need. There are lots of things which have to take place. King couldn't sleep. Shem made a miracle that he was unable to sleep. And the way that kings would put themselves to sleep, their nighttime stories, their bedtime stories, were these Book of Chronicles. It would be boring. It would be old. So they would read it. It would help them fall asleep. That's the most simple, basic line of the story that you can have. Wasn't able to sleep. This is a nice way to put him to bed. Both Rashi and the Gra see much more, however, in that storyline in their follow-up commentary. So Rashi's approach is as follows. Put yourself in the king's position. What just happened the previous day? Nobody threatened his life the previous day. What just happened this day? The party. Who was invited to the party? Esther, Haman, and Ahasuerus are at the party. Now, how did Esther go about creating this party? So she went in where she had not been invited in the previous 30 days to see the king. And as Esther says to Mordechai, when Mordechai tells her, you need to go and save the Jewish people, what was her response? Haven't been called. And what happens if you go into the king's chambers without having been called? Yeah. Off with your head. Now the king also knows that rule. Esther says to Mordechai, everybody in the nation knows the rule. King knows the rule also. He's pretty familiar with it. He's probably put a couple people to death because of that rule. So here he sees his wife is willing to burden herself, risk her life by doing so, and she wants to have a party. No problem. He offers her everything, and she says, let's come to a party. At the party which you went to today, all she asks for is
another party.
And whom did she invite to participate in all of these things? Haman. Now, if you're the king, and your wife risks her life to invite you to a party. Let's go out to dinner, schmooze, we haven't spoken in 30 days. Would it be okay if we just brought Haman along? Is that okay with you? Says Rashi, king is not so pleased with this. There's something in this that is bothering him, troubling him. What's she doing with Haman? What's the issue? Says Rashi in his language, Sumes libo, he placed his heart al shezimna Esther as Haman, on the fact that Esther included Haman, shema nasna eineha, maybe she's got eyes for Haman, the ahargehu, and they're going to kill him. It's a concern. Now, if he's got this concern, he's not able to sleep, he's tossing and turning, there's an oddity, my wife invites Haman to participate in this party. Says Rashi, why does he call for the book of Zichronos? Says Rashi, because I efshar shelo yada adam shehu oyhavai. It's impossible, says Rashi, the king says to himself, when people plot against the king, word leaks around. There's an inner circle of people who find out about it. It's impossible that nobody would have heard about this. Somebody should know. And since somebody should know within my inner circle, how come they're not telling me? How come I haven't heard? I have here this Esther and Haman. Something seems to be going on. The most logical thing that's going to follow is they might be after me. And if they're after me, that then Esther can marry Haman. They'll take over the whole kingdom. Somebody's got to know about something like this. But how come I haven't heard about it? Says the king to himself, according to Rashi, Chazar va'amar, the king said to himself, Shema asali adam tova velo gimaltiv. Somebody did something for me once, and I didn't repay him correctly. Because if they're not talking to me now, it's because they must have once had a bad experience where they told me something, and I didn't repay them in kind. And therefore, they don't care about me anymore. They said, forget about the king, because last time I stepped in and helped him, he didn't do anything. Therefore, he said, tossing and turning, said, bring me the book of Zichronos. Bring me the book of Chronicles. I'm looking for something. What was the king looking for, according to Rashi? Who's done something for me that I haven't done or paid appropriately? Because the thing with the Haman makes me suspicious. I'm uncomfortable with this whole development. And why don't I know anything about it? Who is it that's out there that I haven't repaid in kind? So they're flipping through, they're flipping through, they're flipping through. And what do they come across eventually? Come across the story of Mordechai saving him from Big Son and Seresh. What's the most logical question the king is going to ask according to Rashi? What did we do for him? Answer his pages? Nothing. So So when we leave this first three verses according to Rashi, where we're up to in the story is, the king is suspicious that Haman and Esther are plotting against him. He wants to know why nothing has been done, no one has told him, and now he has his answer. There's this guy, Mordechai the Jew, who saved my life, and I didn't do anything for him. So what's on the king's mind when we leave the story according to Rashi, these first three verses? I gotta fix this problem with Mordechai. Put that thought on hold. Let's learn how the Vilna Gaon learns these first three verses. He picks it up on a very different thread. Says the Vilna Gaon, not concerned, he's not suspicious that Haman and Esther are plotting against him, but there's something else that's bothering him about this party. How did Esther again create this party? What did she do? She put her neck on the line. She literally risked her life to have this party. What's going through the king's mind? If you're the king and your wife risks her life, and she doesn't want to just have a party with you, she invites Haman. If she would have risked her life and left it just her and you, what would you have assumed she wanted?
You.
Quality time with you, right? Just me and him, me and her, together. But she adds Haman into the mix. Now what do you think she wants?
She wants to warn him about her.
What kind of message? So the Vilna Gaon looks at it like this. Since it's not just the two of us, the king must be thinking, she must need something. She must want something. And when you bring the second in command with you, how large of a request is she about to make? A small request or a very large request? Very large request, because she's risking her life to have a meeting with me, and she's bringing the number two guy with her. She clearly wants something huge out of me. Says the king to himself, for whom would Esther possibly be asking for something so great that she needs to risk her life and bring the number two man in order to ask on his behalf? Who would that person be? Mordechai. Now, here we have to take a step back and go all the way back to the second chapter to understand where this would be. Let's introduce one of the biggest elephants in this entire story of the Megillah, in my mind at least. The biggest elephant in the room. How do we answer this question, which is very rarely asked? How in the world was it possible that the king doesn't know who Esther is? There's not a single Jew in the entire 127 provinces who got the word out. They kept the secret. All of them. Nobody has said a word. The king hasn't figured it out. Now, that nobody told him is a question. I don't even have an answer for that. I don't know how that happened. But what did she tell him? How many dates did they go on where the king said to her, so, where are you from? And she sort of giggles, let's not talk about that. How long is that going to go on for before he gets, like, he takes her head off or something? And what's the answer? What do the conversations look like that she's survived all of this time, and he doesn't know where she is? And they took her from Mordechai's house. So let's go back even. Let's go back 1 second. I want to go back. If you go back to chapter 2, verse 10. Flip back in one or two pages. On page 1254. Now this is at the stage where Esther has just been taken. In verse 9, if you flip back to the previous page, verse 9, the girl pleased him. The people who came to take Esther, Haggai, she obtained his kindness. He hardly prepared her cosmetics and her allowance of delicacies to present her and all of her seven maids. And then the Torah says, the Megillah says in verse 10, Esther had not told of her people or her kindred, for Mordechai had instructed her not to tell. Now here's another question which we don't ask because we're so familiar with the story. Why does Mordechai tell her not to tell where she's from? Now, when we read this in the Megillah every year, we sort of think, oh, because a couple of years later, the Jews are going to be in trouble, and therefore she will now be able to pull the card that nobody knew before that she was a Jew, and the whole story will work out very well. But if you're years before this event takes place, Mordechai already instructs her and says, don't tell anyone where you're from. This is the only instruction we have recorded that he gives her. She's about to be taken to the king's palace as they try out to be the wife, the queen of this entire huge empire. And the only instruction he has for her is, don't tell anybody who you are. Why not? Why does Mordechai tell her not to say where she's from? Afraid of what? Why? Why? Could be.
Maybe he didn't want the Jewish people to depend on her.
Interesting.
Well, they
then Ahasuerus wouldn't pick Esther.
Because?
He wouldn't be in the place to save the Jewish people.
So he already knew there was going to be trouble. In other words, so if we go with that approach, then it answers all the questions. If we go with an approach that Mordechai was a Navi, which he was a prophet, and he knew there was going to be problems, then that would be a simple solution. But if we're reading the text without that knowledge, which both Rashi and the Gra are going to do here, what was the reason why he told her not to tell anyone?
Made them do terrible things under her command. So there's already a history of how the Jews were treated badly within the palace.
Okay. And therefore, she doesn't want to say that she's Jewish because...
Well, there might already be different people in the palace who have created a mindset about Jewish people.
Okay, interesting. Listen to how Rashi and the Vilna Gaon address this. Interesting answer. Rashi says as follows, almost the opposite of some of the things that we said. Rashi comments that Esther was a descendant of Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, the very first king of the Jewish people from the tribe of Binyamin. She was a descendant of that family. Had the king known that she was descendant of kings, he would have taken her right away. So to protect her identity and to make it seem like she was a commoner and of little interest to the king, Mordechai instructs her and says, don't tell anyone where you're from. You have a better chance of not being taken if they think of you as a commoner than as the daughter or descendant of kings. So keep it quiet. Maybe you won't be taken. The Vilna Gaon has a little different approach, and he says the reason that he didn't want her to tell her was because Chazal tell us Mordechai was hiding Esther. He didn't want her to be taken. And if it would come out that she was a Jew and didn't want to be queen, everybody wanted to be queen. And here he was hiding her specifically from the king that she shouldn't be taken, that would reflect very poorly on him and all the Jewish people. So to protect them from the fact that she'd been hiding and trying not to be taken, so don't tell anyone why that you are a Jew. Excellent. So now you have a question. So he tells her not to tell her, but doesn't everybody know she was taken from Mordechai's house? Says the Gra, she lied. She said, I don't have parents, which was true. And then she added, Mordechai raised me, which was true, but I don't know where I'm from. There was a very kind Jewish man who took me in. He raised me. That everybody knew. You couldn't hide that. But I don't know who I am. And she maintained this story. Now, the Vilna Gaon makes an amazing comment. Why, again, did Mordechai tell her not to tell anyone? Because either like Rashi, that to protect herself because she would be taken right away if he knew how special she was, or like the Vilna Gaon says, because the Jews shouldn't have a backlash from the fact that they were hiding her. Years go by before the rest of the story happens. Why does she maintain this and not tell anyone? So the Megillah says, since Mordechai commanded her not to tell, she never told, even though the reasons didn't apply anymore. All the reasons were finished and done with. She was now safely in the palace. King liked her. Everything was good, and she still never told. So the commentaries point out, when the sages make a decree, and Mordechai establishing this rule had that status, even though the reasons sometimes don't apply, you never really know the full extent of why and what the value is of their decrees. You abide by it until it's repealed. And since he never went and told her, now you can tell, she maintained the lie that she had said, which she had for good reason. She never changed that. And it turns out, of course, as the story develops, this becomes a critical aspect of it. But it's all an aspect of when a decree was made, even though the reasons sometimes don't apply anymore, and we sometimes think, well, this is silly, why are we still doing this? You never really know what's going to happen. But in any case, she maintains her identity. But part of her identity was, I was raised by Mordechai, but I don't know who I am. Now, this is going to be a very important factor as we get farther into the story. But for now, we're back at our stage. According to the Vilna Gaon, he's restless, sleepless in Shushan. He can't figure out what's going on. And he figures out, if Esther was willing to risk her life to come in, she must have a major request on mind. Must have a major request. She's even bringing in the second in command. Who is the only person that she could possibly be so worried about that she would do all of this, risk her life and bring Haman in for? It would have to be Mordechai, because he knew she had a connection to Mordechai. He just didn't know that she was also Jewish. He thought she was just an orphan off the street that he took in. It must be Mordechai. Now, the king doesn't want to give away whatever it is that Esther is going to request. But if she's going to request something, there's got to be some thing that Mordechai has done that puts him on the map to be entitled to whatever that she's going to ask. Says the Vilna Gaon, the king thinks he's going to preempt whatever the request is going to be. Because this is such a major request, she has two parties in order to get it. So he calls his chamberlains in and he says, bring me that book of Chronicles. I need to find what Mordechai has done that would make Esther think that she's entitled to make this massive request. I don't know what she wants, but let's find out what has he done that she's going to make this request. So according to the Vilna Gaon, when he can't sleep and he calls his chamberlains in to read from the book, he's got a very specific task in mind. And what's that task according to the Vilna Gaon? He's looking for Mordechai. Just to review quickly, when Rashi understood the story, the king called in the book for a specific task also. And that was a more general task of, what did somebody do for me that I haven't repaid? In the Vilna Gaon's world, when he calls for the book, he's asking very specifically focused on Mordechai. Google Mordechai, find all the references to Mordechai in my book, and let's see what he's done that Esther's going to make this massive request. They find the story of Vixen Viseresh. What's the most logical question the king is going to ask? Well, what do we do for him? And their response is, nothing. So at this stage in Rashi's story, the king is thinking, I know a major request is coming from Haman and Esther. Now, parenthetically speaking, what do you think the king thinks the relationship is between Haman and Mordechai? A very good one. So good, in fact, that was the most logical person who Esther brings to the party to ask something for Mordechai. So as far as the king is concerned, because he has no idea, the king is so, which is another whole discussion, but when Haman says there's a people, we need to destroy them, what major question does the king forget to ask? Who are they? No interest. Oh, there's a people, you're going to pay me a lot of money, we'll destroy them? That's fine, go right ahead. He has no idea who these people are. So he has no reason to suspect anything between Mordechai and Haman. And in fact, the fact that who Esther is asking about has to be Mordechai, and she invites Haman, he's thinking they must be good buddies. And they're coming to make this request. So he asks, well, what has Mordechai done for me? Finds out a lot, saved my life, and I haven't done anything for him. So in his mind, as we're going to pick up the story, both according to Rashi and the Vilna Gaon, the king is very concerned with rewarding Mordechai because, A, he's either afraid for his life, and Mordechai must be the one guy who knows something about it and is not telling me, or there's a request coming that I don't want to give into, but I need to find out what it is, and it's Mordechai who's deserving of something because I haven't given him anything. That's where the story's up to. Let's go right there. Let's continue in the story. Verses 4 and 5 back in chapter 6. So that's where the king's head is.
Rabbi,
yeah.
I'm more devious than you are. If you're the king,
yeah,
you have to watch every nuance.
Mm-hmm.
She has Haman in twice.
Well, so far only once.
Once, but okay. If I were king,
mm-hmm,
I'd say, why is she warning me about Haman?
Well, is she warning him?
Why is she calling attention to him?
So in other words, you're asking, in other words, in the Vilna Gaon's approach, that it was in order to make a request, then that makes sense, because they're a team.
Well, on the other side of that is, she is loyal to me, and she's warning me about Haman. They're calling attention to him.
Excellent.
And I cannot, and she cannot accuse the second in command, but she's telling him, pay attention to him.
That's correct. Now, we're going to see that as far as part of her whole plot is to do that, is to bring attention to him, and she's going to try to do so in a backdoor kind of way in order to be able to get him out of the picture. But yeah, she is definitely calling attention to him, and she's done so very purposely to get the king's mind percolating about, like, what exactly is he doing here? That is for sure correct. Now, verse 4, the king said, who is in the courts? So he's got who on his mind? Who's on the king's mind right now?
Mordechai.
He's got to repay him. He's got to somehow get him back on his side or figure out what he's got to do with him. All of a sudden, the Megillah continues and the king says, who's in the courts? Why is he asking this question? Because Haman had just come into the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordechai and the gallows he had prepared for him. What time of day or night is it right now? It's the middle of the night. The king can't sleep. What in the world is Haman doing there? Does Haman know the king can't sleep? What do you mean? He's like throwing pebbles at his windows to wake him up. He's got a message for him. We gotta hang Mordechai. He's talking about, what is he thinking? So the reality is he's not thinking. Now, in order to fully understand how much he's not thinking, we got to go back half a chapter, back to the end of chapter 5. This is after the first party. They're very jet-lagged. It's after the first party. Haman exits, and he's feeling on the top of the world, as we've mentioned. And who does he see? He sees Mordechai, and everything falls apart. Now, let's read exactly the way Haman responds to this. This is on the paragraph right before us, on starting on verse 9 and 10, the end of chapter 5. That day, Haman went out joyful and exuberant, but when Haman noticed Mordechai in the king's gates, and that he neither stood up nor stirred before him, Haman was infuriated with Mordechai. Now, that phrase in Hebrew, Vayimole Haman al Mordechai chema. He was filled with this chema, Lashon Cham, is literally heat or hatred. He was infuriated with him. Now, this word chema has appeared before in the Megillah. It actually appears 4 different times, this language for anger, in the Megillah. Anyone know the first time this word chema appears? That's a tough question. It's actually the very beginning. What's that? That's going to appear after this. In the very first chapter, who gets angry? King is angry at Vashti. Flip back to the first chapter. Verse 12. King has asked for Vashti to come before him, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment conveyed by the chamberlains. The king therefore became very incensed, and his anger burned in him. In Hebrew that reads, Vayiktsof ha-melech ma'od, the king was very incensed, v'chamoso, and his anger, bo'arabo, burned inside him. Now that's a double language here. How many times does the Megillah describe his anger in 2 different words? What's the usual word we use for anger? Ka'as is the general word for you. Now we don't use that word either places. We use the word vayiktsof. He got angry, and then we say vachamaso, and his anger burned within him. The Malbim lived in the 1800s. Reb Meir Leibush, Weiser probably is pronounced, who was a Russian rav who went all over European countries. He was a rabbi in Romania and in Poland. So he wrote a number of commentaries on the text. Megillat Esther was actually the first commentary that he wrote. And when I was Googling his name to get some biographical information, which is always interesting, one of the things they pointed out in the Wikipedia, it's amazing, you can Google Malbim, and the first thing that comes up is, right away, it sends it to Wikipedia, gives you a whole biography, everything about him. One of the things that it commented about him that he focused on in his commentary, whenever the Torah uses similar words, he was a firm believer that there are no real synonyms in the Torah. If the Torah means one thing, it would use that word. If it uses a different word, it's because there are various nuances in the language that the Torah is trying to convey, which is exactly what I wanted to share in this commentary over here. The Malbim comments, why do we use 2 different words for the anger of the king? Vayiktsof, and then we use the word chema, his anger burned within him. Malbim writes, there was a lot going on when the king requested of Vashti to come before him. And on the one hand, he was angry because she didn't listen to him, and that caused him to be angry. But there was another aspect here. The king was a commoner in his origins. That's who he was. He was not a person who came from a royal family. But he ascended to the throne, and he conquered the entire world, almost the entire world known to man at the time. Vashti was a granddaughter of the Babylonian kings, whom he had just conquered. Now, there was a break in her line because her grandfather had been conquered, but she is still a granddaughter of royalty. And there was a lot of tension and power play between King Ahasuerus and Vashti as to, I guess you'd say, who wore the pants in the family. Because he's trying to establish himself as king, but he has no real yichus. He has no background. She has a lot of background, but her family has been defeated and conquered by Persia and this king Ahasuerus. And part of this power play as to why does he ask her to come before him without clothing, just wearing the crown on her head, is to establish the fact that he is in fact king, has married her only because she's a beautiful woman, not because I need her and her royal descent to establish my kingdom. I am a king in my own right, and I will demonstrate that by asking you, forcing you, to come because you're a beautiful woman, to show the reason why I married you is because you're simply beautiful, not because you have any particular lineage or any special right to the throne. When she refuses to come, what is she really saying? I am a queen on my own right, and I don't need you. I am descendant of royalty, and you're really a nothing. King gets angry. Says the Malbim, he's angry on two levels. He's angry, A, because he made a request to his king that wasn't listened to. All right, that's going to get anybody angry, especially if you're the king and you've had a lot to drink for the previous 180 days. So he's angry for that. And the word vayiktsof, says the Malbim, explains or expresses an outer anger, an anger that you can show and express. Chema, says the Malbim, is a deeper inner anger that's not expressed for various reasons, but it's a passionate inner anger that there's something underlying this issue that's eating at you, that makes you infuriated, but for whatever reason, you can't really express it. He couldn't express that the reason why he was so angry is because he was just stepped on by his queen. That's not something that a king of 127 provinces can say, I can't believe my wife just did that to me. So the anger that he outwardly expressed was, she didn't listen to me, I can't have that. But what's really going on, v'chamaso ba'arobo, that this infuriating other type of word is expressing inside what's really eating at him, but he can't express, I'm trying to show my kingship, and she's not letting me. She's rejecting that, and that's what Ba'arobo burned within him. Parenthetically speaking, this lesson of the Malbim is a tremendous lesson. Very often we get angry at people, spouses, children, parents, and there are two levels of the anger that's going on. There's the outward expression of anger. Person made a request, or whatever happened, was offended, and I'm angry that whatever happened, you didn't listen to, agree with me, acknowledge, whatever it was. But deep down below, there's a much more powerful anger that you're not able to express, either because you're embarrassed about it or you're too sensitive to, but that's really the issue that's burning up inside, not the external anger. If you ask the king, hey, why are you so angry? So the king would say, well, I'm angry because I made a request of the queen and she didn't listen. Why are you really angry? Well, I'm really angry because I'm feeling like a nothing because I'm trying to establish my kingship and you're not letting me. And that's really infuriating me, but I can't express that. So the response she gets is from that inner burning desire anger, even though that was never expressed. That's the language of the chema, but what's expressed is that you didn't listen to me. Now, with that background, the word chema, what word do we use for Haman? When Haman sees Mordechai, how does the Megillah describe his feelings towards Mordechai there in verse 9? Vayimole Haman al Mordechai chema. Haman was filled against Mordechai with chema. Which type of anger is that?
Burning.
Now, why can't he be expressive of his anger? What's he angry about? Won't bow down to me. How does it look for the second in command of the most powerful empire in the world to have a single Jew who won't bow down to you, and you get angry about that? Like, really angry about that? Looks pretty pathetic. It's pretty petty. So petty, in fact, that the Megillah itself already says, the first time that Haman sees Mordechai not bowing down, and he wants to kill him, why doesn't he kill him there in the spot? Vayivez be'enof. It would be degrading. That's like, how petty is that, that I have a single guy who won't bow down to me, and I have to... I can't do it. So what if Haman devised instead? So we're going to knock off the entire Jewish people as a cover to be able to get at what's really eating at me, which is this Jew Mordechai. And now I see it again. I'm the top of the world. Number two in command, invited to a party with the king and the queen, and there's this Mordechai character. Vayimole Haman. He can't express it. Now there's more than that that he can't express. The Medrash says that years before, Haman and Mordechai were old acquaintances, and they'd been involved years before. They were on a boat together, and they didn't have any food. Haman didn't have any food. Mordechai did. And Haman asks Mordechai for the food, and Mordechai makes a deal. If you'll be my slave, I'll provide you with your food. And they agree. They sign a document. And the Medrash takes this throughout this whole story, that the whole time Mordechai held himself above Haman because of this episode which had happened years before. And Haman can't express that either. A slave to this guy Mordechai, the second in command. The documents clearly no longer valid, but it's there, and Mordecai knows it's there, and Haman knows it's there, and every time Haman walks past, he sees Mordecai, who refuses to bow down, and he's filled with this chema, this inner raging, passionate anger that you can't really express why, but it's there, and it's eating up at him. Listen to his response. Verse 10, continuing on 1257 in the fifth chapter. Nevertheless, he restrained himself and went home, sends for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Now listen to what he says to his friends and his wife, people who ostensibly know him pretty well. Do you think Haman told people that he was invited to a party with the king and queen?
Sure.
Is there any chance in the world that every single one of his inner circle, and far beyond his inner circle, didn't know what he had been doing that afternoon? There's no way in the world that everybody doesn't know this. So he's coming back from this party, and everyone's going to be saying to him, well, what happened? They know where he went. There's no way they don't know where he went. He gathers them together, and he recounts to them the glory of his wealth, his many sons, and every instance where the king had promoted him and advanced him above the officials and royal servants. Who's he talking to?
His wife
and his close friends and kids, and he says, do you know how wealthy I am? And he lists to them how wealthy he is. Do you know how many times the king has appointed me? Do you know how many children I have? I'm looking at him, my dad, yeah, we know how many children. I mean, this is his wife you're talking to, and his kids are gathered around. And he's saying, and he says, moreover, Queen Esther invited no one but myself to accompany the king, and tomorrow too I am invited. Now that part they wouldn't have known, but they knew that he went there. So he's telling things to people who for sure know just about everything. How does he sound? Like a man possessed by his anger, sitting down like a pathetic little creature. Do you know how wealthy I am? Do you know how many children I have? How many promotions I've got? I went to a banquet with the queen and the king, just me. And then he says, and all of this means nothing to me as long as I see this Jew Mordecai. So you get the picture of a man who is now totally obsessed with the situation. Totally obsessed with getting back at Mordecai. He's ruined everything for him. He's sitting with his wife, with his kids, going over things that they know. Can you believe this? And Mordecai. Now his wife says an interesting thing to him. What does she say to him? I know. Why don't we kill Mordecai? That's what she says, right? What's Haman's response to that? Great idea. I have a question. We're in chapter 5 here. How many chapters has Haman hated Mordecai's guts for? Good, solid 3 chapters, several years of our story have gone by. Why didn't Haman think of this? I mean, she doesn't say anything creative. She doesn't say, let's poison his food, let's figure out a way, let's hire an assassin. She says, hey, let's kill Mordecai. He says, oh, brilliant idea. How come I didn't think of that? Well, the truth is he did think of it. What did he say to himself the first time he thought of that? It would seem petty. It would give away the whole plot that I have. Is really just that's a petty plot. But now, a little bit later in the story, the whole situation has changed. He is so possessed and obsessed with getting rid of Mordecai, his wife says, I know, let's get rid of him. And like all of a sudden, this is a great idea. Even though it would belie his entire motive for this entire pogrom that he's orchestrated, which was in order not to look petty about getting rid of just Mordecai. And at this point of our story, he's totally fine with this idea. Now, he shows up back to chapter 6. He shows up to the king. The king has one thing on his mind. What's that? Mordecai. I got to pay back Mordecai. Haman shows up in the middle of the night in the palace. Comes to the palace in the middle of the night because he's got one thing on his mind. What's that? Kill Mordecai. And the two of them meet in the palace in the middle of the night. The king's got Mordecai in his mind. Haman's got Mordecai in his mind. The king wants to reward Mordecai. Haman's ready to kill him. And here they are in the middle of the night. Let's see what happens. King says, bring Haman in. Haman came into the king. When Haman came in, the king says to him, what should be done for the man whom the king especially wants to honor? Now, Haman has an agenda when he walks into the king's palace. And that's to kill Mordecai. He does not get to open up his mouth. And the first thing out of the king's mouth is, how would you honor and give glory to somebody? Somebody you desire to honor. Now, if there was only one thing that was going to get Haman out of his obsessive, possessive mind of killing Mordecai, the only thing that would be himself and his own honor. And as the Megillah says, Haman reasons himself, well, put Mordechai aside for a second, who else could it possibly be that I'd be, the king would be interested in bestowing honor other than myself? So Haman says to the king as follows, well, for the man whom the king especially wants to honor, well, bring a royal robe that the king has worn, a horse that the king has ridden, and one with a royal crown on his head. Then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble officers. Let them attire the man, and then parade him on horseback through the city square, proclaiming, this is what we do for the man who wants to honor the king. Now, go back to the king's mind. Now, we have two storylines that we've developed, Rashi and the Vilna Gaon storyline. According to Rashi, how did the king understand the fact that Haman had been invited to the party? There was something going on between he and Esther. So you're the king. It's the middle of the night. You can't sleep. You're suspicious of something going on between Haman and Esther. The only reason why you can reason why you don't know about it already is because someone is out there who you haven't repaid in kind, and you need to find out who that person is, and you got it. Who is it? Mordechai. Who are you trying to protect yourself from? Haman. You ask Haman, what would you do to honor him? And he starts talking about royal garments, crowns, royal horse, putting this person on it. And what are you thinking as the king? This is Haman's guy. Right? This is not going. You're already confirming all of your suspicions about Haman. Who would be the first person that you would appoint to do all those things to your Mordechai and parade him through the city? Would be Haman, because this is a guy who needs to be put in his place a little bit. Otherwise, it's a little odd when you think about the fact that the king, in the middle of the night, here there's a conversation of Haman, sends Haman himself to do all these things. Haman is a second in command. That's not the person you would send to dress up Mordechai and send him through the town, leading him by a horse, except for the fact that you think Haman, something's going on. You don't mind in any way, shape, or form putting Haman a little bit in his place and removing him. And according to the Vilna Gaon's approach, that you wanted to reward Mordechai in order that you can preempt the whole discussion that's going on. So Haman would be the most likely person, since he's on Mordechai's side. He's with Esther coming to make the request. So say, you do it yourself. You reward him, you repay him. So by the second party, I don't have to be so concerned about what they're going to ask for. I've already given him all that he needs. So that's what goes on. Mordechai is put in all the royal garments by Haman. Haman leads him through the town. Okay, now, let's pick up on verse 12. Mordechai returns to the king's gate. He's led through the town. Things are looking good for Mordechai. And Haman hurries home, despondent and with his head covered. Nidchaf el beso, the language of the Megillah. Avel, despondent. The sages understand from the word despondent that he was actually an avel. He was a mourner. That his daughter, when she saw that it was him, she had dumped garbage out of the window, thinking it was Mordechai leading Haman. Instead, she finds out it was her own father. She kills herself. So he's in Ovel, and he's covered. He's all despondent, and things are going poorly. Now, this next verse is in my mind, one of the strangest verses in the entire Megillah. The scene is Haman has just returned home. He left the house in the morning, going to kill Mordechai, or in the middle of the night. He now comes home after leading Mordechai through the streets. Listen to this verse, verse 13. Haman told his wife Zeresh and all of his friends everything that had happened to him, and his advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordechai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will undoubtedly fall before him. Say, well, if Mordechai is a Jew, then you're in trouble. If Mordechai is a Jew, then you're in trouble? What have we been talking about this entire time? They didn't know Mordechai was a Jew. They didn't know that Haman hated Mordechai because he was a Jew. Mordechai HaYehudi, as he's described in Time of Gil, and she says to him, if Mordechai is a Jew and you've begun to fall, forget it, it's all over. What does she mean when she says, if Mordechai is a Jew, you'll have begun to fall before him? Vilna Gaon has a comment here, brilliant insight. Put yourself in the shoes of Haman's wife, Zeresh. When you sent your husband out in the middle of the night, with what did you send him? Sent him to go kill Mordechai. The next time he's in, there's no email, there's no cell phone, so there's no communication from the time that he leaves the house until the time that he comes back. So you don't know what's going on. But all that you know is that you sent him out of the house, number two in command in the entire nation, been invited to a party with Esther and the king, now been invited to a second party. He leaves to go tell the king to kill Mordechai, and the next thing you see, Haman is leading Mordechai through the streets of Shushan. What is your only conclusion as to how in the world we got from point A to point B? What would she be thinking? So forget religion. Not even there. King said no. You have to be thinking, says the Vilna Gaon. Haman must have made his request to Ahasuerus and said, I want to kill Mordechai. And what was the king's most likely request or response? Why? You present whatever you wanted to present, and the king must have called in Mordechai. They had some sort of din Torah. They had a court decision, and Mordechai made his arguments, and Haman made his arguments. And it must be that the king sided with Mordechai, and now that Haman had lost his debate, has somehow been punished and being forced to lead Mordechai through the streets, but it's all over for Haman. This number two in command business, you can forget about it. He just made a request that Mordechai killed and it was rejected. So you could surely assume that it's all over for Haman. So when Haman walks in the door, in Zeresh's mind, his wife's mind, what does she think is coming next? Haman probably is going to be killed, if not for sure he's being demoted. And this whole business of the wealth and the second in command, it's out the window. Because look what happened. He left to go kill Mordechai, and something happened, but he ends up leading Mordechai, riding a horse in the king's vestment, all through the town. So it's all over. So she comes in the door, and he's hurrying around, and she's thinking he's hurrying to get out of the country because he's going to be killed. And what does Haman say to her? He says, no, you got it all wrong. You're not going to believe what happened on the way to the palace today. That's what he's going to say. He's going to say, I didn't even open up my mouth to make the request. You're not going to believe the odd series of occurrences which happened. I'm on my way to the palace. You're not going to believe it. The king couldn't sleep tonight. Of all nights, the king can't sleep. This is what happened. He couldn't sleep. Yes, he calls the book, Mordechai. He asks me what I would do to honor somebody. Like this has nothing to do with my plan. I was going to kill Mordechai. Weirdest set of events. You're not going to believe it, but that's what happened. I'm still number two. King does nothing against me. He just wanted to honor Mordechai. I'm still heading back to the party. Everything is in order. Don't worry about all these events. What's the language the Megillah uses to describe the way that Haman tells his family? What word does it use? Vayisaper Haman in verse 13, which we just read. Vayisaper Haman, Lazarus Ishto, he told over Es Kol Asher Karohu. All that happened to him. Where do we see that word used over and over again in Vayikra, in Mikra, by chance? It just happened to be that way. And Zeresh responds to him and says, Haman, we got a big problem here. You think it was Mikra, an odd set of events and occurrences that you never would have been able to put together and they just happened to fall into place on this very night? In Mizera HaYehudim, if Mordechai is a Jew, then we're stuck. Because these things don't just happen to the Jews. When it comes to the Jews, ain't mikra. There's no such thing as happenstance. Ain't mazal Yisrael. There's no just like, well, this is the way that things work. Things don't work that way by the Jews. If you would have told me that you lost the battle, fine, maybe we could work with it. But if you told me that it was the most weird, bizarre occurrences which just happened to all fall out in the same time, in the same place, we're stuck. If you've started to fall before Mordechai, and he's a Jew, under these circumstances, then the whole thing is finished because that doesn't work. Things don't work that way for the Jews, and we are going to be kaput. That is the way that the Vilna Gaon says. That's why she says it in this way. If you've begun to fall before him under these circumstances, which you think is just Mikra, there's no such thing as Mikra, there's no such thing as happenstance by the Jews, and it's all over. As this chapter concludes, when they were still talking to him, they rush Haman to the banquet. Okay, I do a little bit more. I know it's almost about an hour, but we'll just do a little bit more to set us up for the finale next week. Let's just read the first couple verses of chapter 7 and to tie that up. So the king and Haman come to feast with Queen Esther. So now all of these events have taken place between the first and second party. King can't sleep, calls the book, he's got Mordechai in line, rewards him appropriately. Mordechai is returned, but he's still... When the verse said that Mordechai returned to the king's gates, Rashi points out he's back in his sackcloth. He's mourning because we still have a decree out against all the Jewish people being led through the streets or not being led through the streets. That doesn't change the fact that he's lined up to die together with all of his people. So, which is always just an oddity of parenthetical thought when you think about what the experiences was like. Here you have a Jewish people. They're all in sackcloth. They've been fasting for 3 days for Esther to go in to make the request. This is just the day after the request. It's that very night. And what are they afraid of? They're all going to die. They look out the window the following morning, and what do they see? Mordechai is being led through the city in the king's clothing, and they're still going to die. That hasn't changed. Nothing has happened as far as that goes. So they're still far from being out of the woods. And Mordechai, as soon as he gets finished off the horse, he right away goes back to the king's gate and puts on his sackcloth to continue fasting and praying and mourning the fact that they're about to be destroyed. Meanwhile, back in the palace, we're having the second party, Esther Haman, who's now totally tzimished because he just was leading Haman, the whole thing. They sit down. King asks again, "Ask of me what you want, and it shall be fulfilled." King responds as follows. Let's read this inside 3 and 4 of what she says. Queen Esther answers and says, "If I have won your majesty's favor, and if it pleases the king, let my life be granted to me as my request, and my people as my petition. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, slain, and exterminated." True or false? Is Esther in danger? Nobody knows who she is. So she herself is part of a people that might be lined up. She herself is not in any danger. But she expresses it to the king, "Let my life be granted to me." Nafshi b'she'elasi. My life is at stake here. I and my people. Now, why would Esther be very hesitant to say this?
She just blew the whole thing.
There's a big lie that she's exposing, that she's been living for the past 4 or 5 years. What has she been telling the king this entire time? I don't have a people. She has to have actually said that. She could not have gotten away with just saying, "Let's not talk about that." She said to him, I was raised by Mordechai. He took me in, but I don't know who I am and where I'm from. And now she exposes herself and she says, I do have a people and I care about them. Now, next week we'll fill this in even more, why this is so significant. But she's getting rid of that which she's built up and been living for a significant amount of time. Now, she says, "Had we been sold as slaves and servant girls, I would have kept quiet. For the adversary is not worth the king's damage." Now in the Hebrew, the actual language that she says, "Ilu la'avadim u'lishvachos nimkarnu," had we just been sold, "hecharashti," I would have kept silence. Where has that word appeared before in the Megillah? Yeah, no. So this word appears when Mordechai first makes his request to Esther, that she needs to go in and speak to the king. This is in chapter 4. Let's do 12, 13, and 14. 12, they related Esther's words to Mordechai. When Esther said, "I can't go in, everybody knows I'll be killed." Flip back, this is in chapter 4, page 1256. And Mordechai said to reply back to Esther, "Do not imagine that you will be able to escape in the king's palace any more than the rest of the Jews." He says, so don't think you're going to be safe in there. "For if you persist in keeping silence at a time like this, relief and deliverance will come to the Jews from some other place. Ki im hacharesh tacharishi. If you will remain silent here, at rebach v'hatzalo yamod la'yehudim mimakom acher, if you remain silent, we will be saved from some other place, and you and your father's house will be lost." Why will she be lost? Why will her father say? Now, to a woman, to a girl who doesn't have a father or a mother, it's a funny thing to say, not only will you be lost, but your father's house will be lost. She doesn't have a father. She lost her mother and father when she was an infant.
But his house,
or her house, father's house,
the family.
But she clearly has absolutely no family, because who raises her? Mordechai takes her in. So he's saying about himself, "I'll lose my own family." It's interesting. And the language that he uses is hacharesh tacharishi, if you will be silent. Now, she's now using this language when she speaks to the king and says, had we only been sold as slaves, then I would have kept silence. But now that we were being killed, I have to speak up. Now, this language that Mordechai uses to Esther, hacharesh tacharishi, is also not an original. That's actually used before somewhere else. Now this is a much more complex question. Where this shows up? This actually shows up in this Chumash, this language of Hachareish Tacharishi before, that Mordechai is borrowing when he says originally to Esther, you need to go speak to the king. Any guesses? Not from Yosef. Page 902, those of you who have the Chumash in front of you, beginning of Parshas Matos, which is the end of Sefer Bamidbar, in a series of laws which seem to have absolutely nothing to do with our story, the Torah begins discussing the laws of a neder. A person can take a vow. So if a person takes a vow, whatever he says with his words become binding on him. There's such a law. You say that you're going to do something, then it becomes binding. There is a law that if a girl who is still living under 12, living in her father's home, or a wife takes a vow, her father, if it's the young girl, or her husband, on the day that he hears of it, has the ability to nullify it. You can say, listen, I'm still somehow connected to this girl, and the vow that she's taking will adversely affect me or adversely affect her, and I have the right to nullify it. But if on the day that he hears it, he is silent, if he doesn't say anything, then whatever she took upon herself becomes binding. She took a vow. You have veto power, but you only have veto power on the day that you hear it. If that day goes by, and you heard it, and you were silent, then the vow is binding. If she violates the vow, she's unable to keep it. On whose head is the punishment for this vow? Says the Chumash, the husband. Because you had the ability to nullify it, and you didn't. Now the language, look in page 902, verse 15. V'im hachareish yachareish lo isha. The exact same language that Mordechai uses, except this is the masculine form, because it's referring to, if the husband will remain silent against her vow, and then she violates it, the nosas avonah, the end of Pasuk Tazayin, it becomes on his head, the vow, because he had the ability to nullify. That same language is the language that Mordechai then uses to Esther in Tachareish, in Acharesh Tacharishi, if you will be silent at a time like this. There are certain times where there's an option where you have a question is posted and you could either answer yes, no, or somewhere in the middle and say maybe or I don't know. But there are other circumstances where you don't have that option of being wishy-washy about it, just saying you're really not sure what to do. You just think as an example, if a person goes to a doctor, they're suffering from something, they're not really sure what it is, and the doctor says, you have X and Y disease, these are the two specialists in the world, go seek out their advice what to do. And you go to one, and he says, the only option you have is surgery. It's your only option. If you don't do the surgery, you'll die. You go to the other specialist, and he says the exact opposite. You need to do nothing. I know why the other doctor said what he said. I believe you need to do nothing. If you do the surgery, it'll kill you. Two opinions. Surgery is the only way to save your life, or the surgery is going to kill you. You don't have an option of not making a decision. You can't say, I don't know what to do. Because not doing anything is making a decision. And very often in life, we end up in situations where we might like to think that we can sort of hold off on making a decision, but sometimes it doesn't work that way. Sometimes the circumstances that you have before you force a decision one way or another, and you can't do nothing. And if you're silent, Torah says to a husband, if you hear your wife make a vow and you're silent, you have affirmed it. You have made the vow binding, and it's on your head whatever will happen. Mordechai uses this language to Esther and says, in Hachareish Tacharishi, if you will be silent now, then you and your father's house are lost. Your silence is an affirmation of whatever is going on. You can't be silent right now. You have to step up and do something. Esther uses that exact same language when she comes to the king and says, had we only been sold as slaves, I actually would have been silent. I would have waited for a better time. I would have waited till you called me in. But we were threatened with death. And as we're threatened with death, I don't have that option. I had to come in and do something. We'll leave it at here, and we'll go through Mirtz Hashem next week, what she does, how it plays itself out, and why it was such a big deal for her to do that, and where the actual climax of the story is. But we'll leave that at here for now. We'll pick up Mirtz Hashem next Wednesday. Next Wednesday is 8:15. Have a great night.